This is an oral history interview for Mystic Seaport Museum. The narrator is Mr. Briggs Cunningham. The interviewer is Fred Calabretta. We're at Mr. Cunningham's home in Rancho Santa Fe, California. And the date is March 31st, 1990. Okay, well, just as sort of a formal beginning, if you would just give your full name and your date of birth.
All right, I'm Briggs S. Cunningham. And I was born in 1907. In Cincinnati, Ohio, and that makes me, I'm 83 years old now, I'm getting sort of long in the tooth, don't get around as much as I used to.
And how did you first get involved with sailing? I think I read somewhere that you would...
In the summertime, my father died when I was 6 years old, and then my mother used to go and up to Martha's Vineyard. She'd rent a house up there for the summer in Edgartown. And I remember going up there. I had an older sister that was 5 years older than I was. And she'd rent a, we'd get one of the cat boats with a skipper in it, and we'd go out and sail or fish or fool around and learn something about sailing. And that's my first introduction to sailing, was up in Martha's Vineyard. And we went up there for quite a few summers. And I remember I was up there during the war, First World War, and I think a friend of mine lived from Boston, lived next door, and there was another chap lived down next to him. The three of us lived in adjoining houses out on the point, and we formed a club, and we had 22 rifles, and we had a lookout. One of us had to be on lookout all the time for German submarines coming into the harbor. And then we were going to shoot the guys when they came ashore with our 22s. you imagine these kids.
You had your own plan for defense there.
Oh, yeah, the three of us. Yeah, we were going to defend the point out there and protect everybody and all the silly business and stuff like that. But anyway, that's where I first got my love of sailing. And the skipper we had was very nice and liked to sail. And we used to go across to the mainland once in a while. And my older sister was, she'd go over there and get invited over to somebody's house or something, and we'd go over in the boat instead of taking the ferry, sail over in an old cat boat. And they were nice old boats, those old cat boats, and had quite a bit of helm on them, but they were, seemed to get around all right, an old one-cylinder Lathrop engine in it. And
so once you got out there and got started and sailing, it's something that you liked from the start.
Yeah, I've always liked it ever since, and I've always loved to sail. And we got older, and then my mother took a house up in Southport, Connecticut one summer, and there's a little yacht club, Southport Yacht Club there, and the Pequod Yacht Club it's called, and they had a class of starboats, and some other class, I've forgotten what it was. Anyway, my mother found somebody wanted to sell their starboat, so I bought that. I think it was $50 or something at the time. It was number 63, the old Scorpio. So she was the first boat I ever owned, sailboat, and I learned to sail on her. And a friend of mine went to the same school I did, up to Hill School, and he used to crew with me, and we'd go out and try to learn from our superiors what sailing was all about and what not to do and the rules. And then we went down to Larchmont Junior Day and around the Sound, stuff like that, and got pretty keen about it.
So that was when you started racing with the Star?
Yeah, so we started racing the Star boats, and they had a little fleet there in the clubhouse. And then that gradually worked into Atlantic-class boats, which we graduated into Atlantics, and then as I got older, I got into 6 meters, and my father-in-law had an 8 meter. He and I had an 8 meter together. We sailed that on the Sound a couple of seasons, and then we had then he got a 12 meter, and it's called Nyala, and I got a chance to sail that a few times on the Sound, go on the New York cruises and stuff like that, and got into the bigger boats and got to know the people down the Sound.
I wanted to ask you what influence Mr. Bedford had on your sailing career.
He had a lot of influence. He was a very good sailor and had sailed all his life. And I remember telling me that when he graduated from, he went to Amherst. When he graduated from Amherst, his father gave him a boat, and it was an old Harrishoff cat boat, or it was a new one. Harrishoff built for him, and they must have been wonderful old boats on the Sound in those days. The old sandbaggers, I guess, even before they had the regular cat boats. And it was long gone when I arrived on the scene, but he used to tell me stories and show pictures of it. He used to sail down the Sound and go to the race and then sail back again. He didn't have any powerboat to get back and forth in those days. And then, of course, he got a big powerboat, and we used to go down there in the morning, and he'd play golf in the morning, and we'd play golf in the morning. And then he would, we'd jump on the powerboat and have lunch on the way down. Jump on the sailboat, race, jump back in the powerboat, have something to eat coming home, and get home in time for supper. So that was it was a commuter, which he'd do about 24, 25 knots. And she was about 72 feet. She was a nice boat. And that was much later on.
And then, you were involved in the first, or one of the first intercollegiate races, is that right?
I think I think it was Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. When I was still at college or not, I think I may have been. We got together and we had two 8-meters at the club, at our Pequod Yacht Club, and we got another one somewhere. We got three boats. We borrowed three, we got the owners to loan us the three boats. We ran some races off Pequod Yacht Club there in Southport. And that was the first intercollegiate races that I remember, Yale, Harvard, and Princeton. And then they gradually added more colleges to it, and then they had to get in a different class of boats so that they could borrow more boats.
Who was officiating or sort of coordinating things during that racing? Do you recall? Or I read somewhere that maybe Sherman Hoyt was involved. Is that...
Oh, I think Sherman may have been involved. There was one of the members of our club, a fellow named Joe Watkins, who was very good about helping out and running races for kids and stuff like that. And I think he worked for General Electric, and he'd take some time off and come down. For the week and run these races and get them started. And there was Uncle Jack Schott, who was my former wife's uncle, and my father-in-law's, married my father-in-law's sister, one of his sisters, so that would make him a relative. And he lived right there, and he had a automobile agency, I think Dodge and something else over in Bridgeport. And he used to help. He loaned boats and borrow boats for us and help us and get it organized and that sort of thing.
Well, that's interesting because...
It was pretty small scale in those days. Because you got more clubs, then you had to get a club that had more boats, different one-design boats, if you could. And they began to move to other clubs, and then other clubs used to win the races, and they'd want them at their own club.
And then...
Go ahead.
I was just going to... wanted to ask you about... Of course, about 6 meters, and your first 6 meter was what had been a Clinton Crane.
Yeah, Mr. Clinton Crane built a boat called Akabaw, and he took it to Scotland, I think, that year. I don't know how I've forgotten how he did come out. See, it was a good boat, and at the end of the season, I bought it from him, and then I got married, and that fall. That fall, and we shipped the boat over to, or was it the next year, maybe the next year. I sailed her, I know, for a season or two down on the Sound, Long Island, the 6-meter class. And she did very well, and she was a good boat. And then my wife and I shipped her over to the south of France, and, I'm getting ahead of myself. That was on our honeymoon we did that. We shipped the boat over, and I had a skipper, paid hand on her, a Swedish boy, I've forgotten his name, Moberg, I think his name was, and he'd sailed with me on the Sound, sailed a boat, and then we got a chap, another paid hand from Scotland, that also worked on a Scottish 6-meter boat, and he came down and joined me down there in Cannes, and we had the boat and went along through the circuit there, Cannes, and they used to have a series of races at each of those little harbors along there, Villefranche and Cannes, and I forgot the other names, but along the Mediterranean. And that was sort of a winter series. We had boats from Italy, we had boats from Denmark, King of Denmark came down, sailed in his boat. Swedish boats were there, and it was a pretty good international sort of regatta. Just. And we'd go from one, they'd put on, this town would put on a series of maybe two or three races. And we'd go down there, tow the boats down or sail them down, and then run the races and then come back to Cannes again and haul the boat, clean it off, and go to the next race. Hmm. But it was sort of a series of regattas, and it started in Italy, and I didn't go down to Italy at Genoa. I think they had the first one of the series. But we won a series up on in Cannes with the Acaba that year, and I renamed her Lucy after my wife and had her, and then it was had it on the 6-meter team up on the Sound. And I think, I don't know whether we... Well, my memory isn't as good as it was. I think we... I don't know whether she ever went to Europe on the team or not. I think she... I don't think we were doing the racing with England at that time, or British-American Cup races or something, that they got going between Suwanee. And then I joined Suwanee Yacht Club over in Oyster Bay in... Oyster Bay. And we used to go over there and race and at their regattas. And I got a little towboat to tow around. And I had two paid hands in, and they had the two pros, and they lived on the powerboat. And I had a mooring down at Larchmont Yacht Club, where I also had a membership. And they'd stay there during the week and then tow the boat over, and I'd meet them over wherever the races were. And then they'd go back to Larchmont and to their moorings.
Hmm. So you were doing a lot of 6-meter.
Yeah, we were pretty busy. I was doing that all summer. And I got into the 6 meters, and then I sold the Acaba, and Mr. Crane designed me a new boat called Lucy, and I built her. And she was probably a little better boat than Acaba, but better, I think she was better reaching and running, and not maybe as good on the wind, but she was, we had her on the British, on the American teams a couple of times, and then got Olin Stevens designed me Lulu, which was the last 6-meter I had. I got models of them all back in here somewhere. I haven't put up yet, but... and she was more of a heavy weather boat, and we did pretty well with her and had her on the teams. Took her to Europe and back, and so I was busy all... I didn't go to the Mediterranean anymore. That was just a one-year job. It wasn't sort of worth it, really. They had a lot of parties in the evenings, and we didn't keep... go to the, gee, they'd sit up and, I didn't drink, so I had an awful time at all these parties because they were always drinking and, you know, getting high and stuff like that and carrying on. And I used to want to go home and get some sleep. So neither my wife or I drank, and we were just young kids in that time, according to the, compared with most of the people in the teams, and they were all older people. But I remember King of Norway was very nice. He came down, he sailed a boat one day, he liked it very much, and came out and sailed our boat one time, just went out on the boat. And he was teaching my wife to tango and stuff like that.
Do you remember some of the other people from the other boats, the other crews?
The other American boat, was a chap by the name of Walter Bowes from Stamford, Connecticut. I think he designed postage meters. Bowes Postage Meter had a factory down in Stamford, and he'd been a sailor a long time around the Sound, a very good sailor, and he built a boat, Salima, I think it was called. I think Sherman Hoyt designed it for him, and he brought her over, and the two of us made up the American team. There were two boats from each country on this sort of round-robin affair, and we came out with the most number of points, so we won the trophy. But I think I don't think she was quite as good as Lucy, and she just, either he didn't sail her quite as well, but he was under the weather half the time. I don't know whether that must have had something to do with it, but God, he was, every night, he just was really a tearing drunk. So whether that affected his sailing, I don't know, but I don't think it helped in any. It
didn't help.
No.
Do you remember some of the people from the other countries, maybe some of the characters from some of the other...
There was Sven Selin from Sweden. I remember he was down there. And then Sven Selin was the first one that brought the Genoa jib to the United States when we first saw it over there one time. We called it a Swedish jib because he was Swedish. And he had put it on a boat, I think, in Lightweather, down in Italy, and designed this overlapping jib for the boat, or had it made. And, of course, on Long Island Sound, it went pretty well with that big jib, and everybody immediately got Genoa jibs for their boats, copied that. I don't remember too many of the other people. Sherman Sale Lee, the old Lee, quite a bit. I've forgotten who owned her. I think a boy down in Larchmont owned her. Freddie Nichols, I think his name was, but I'm not sure now. And Sherman did very well with Lee, especially in light weather. She was a light weather boat. But a lot of the other guys, I just don't remember too much.
And most of them were older, though, you think, older than yourself?
Yeah, most of them were older men. They had businesses in New York or something, would sail on weekends or something and make up the teams and team races. And most of the time it was weekend sailing.
Were there any women in any of the international crews?
Not that I know of. I don't remember that. I don't remember anybody. My wife used to run. She handled the main sheet and the backstays on our boat. And I remember she going along. She'd sail some of the time. She'd turn the boat over to her. And she was a very good sailor. I learned to sail a lot from her and from her sisters, who were very good sailors. She had two sisters that were very good sailors. And their father had gotten an old oysterman. I can't think of his name either. And he was a skipper on his powerboat, but also taught the girls to sail, because he used to be sail in the old days, of course, when they were dredging for oysters, and had a sailboat at the time, and didn't know much about racing, but knew when a boat was on the wind or when it wasn't, or when the sails were shaking, or knew all the red tape about it. And early parts.
I guess in 1931 there were Suwanaka Cup races in Scotland, and you crewed on Priscilla 3, an 8-meter.
Yeah, that was Johnson DeForest's boat. T. DeForest, he asked me if I'd go over with him, and because I wasn't working too much in those days, I was sort of just doing a lot of sailing and playing golf and whatnot. And he asked me to go, and I said, sure, I'd love to go. And we didn't do too well on the 8-meter. I wrote an article, I think, for it. It was in Yachting Magazine, a description of the series and whatnot, how it came out. But we lost. It was for the Suwanaka Cup, which is a two-boat race. But we didn't win it. We didn't get it back.
Who else was on the boat with you? Do you recall?
I think a fellow named Norris Hoyt. I think he was some relation of Sherman's, but I don't. He was a lot younger, but I don't remember just what. Whether he was a nephew or a cousin, maybe a nephew, but he was used to crew with quite a lot of people, and I think he was on the boat with us. And I don't remember whether Rod went over with us that year or not. I honestly don't. I don't remember who the crew was.
And who crewed for you during all the 6-meter years and the British America Cups?
Well, there were Larry and Bob. Larry Rabine was one of my pretty steady crew members. My wife, Larry Rabine, and I had the two pros. I think that was our crew, because you had five in a boat, or you could have five in a boat was the maximum. and you were allowed two crews, and I had the two paid hands who were with me all the time, and I could always count on them, and they were there and took care of the boat, which lived in Larchmont, and I lived up in Southport. So they had they had lived on a little Richardson cruiser, a little boat, and they had the mooring down in Larchmont, and then it was right near the boatyard in Evans, because we'd haul her and clean her every once in a while, you know, and or she'd be going down to Ratsey's for sales, check on sales or get new sales or look at them or something. And so it was right near City Island. Mm-hmm. And I lived up in Southport, which was quite a ways out. It was really too far to tow all the time. But I don't know, various people sailed with me. I just don't remember. My kids never, they were too young, unfortunately, to get in the 6 meters. And they had their own little boats they were learning to sail, and they didn't go on the 6 meters. But I don't know, we always had no trouble getting crews. Sometimes you had trouble getting a crew that could go to Europe. Usually it was kids that were either in college or something that had the summer off.
Hmm. And were those two paid hands with you right throughout the 30s?
They were there for pretty all the time I had sixes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were pretty much the same. And then I think Teddy Thorson came with me, I think, and stayed with me until Mr. Bedford got the 8 meter. And then I think he went with, and he and I owned the 8 meter together. And then I think Teddy went as skipper on the 8 meter. And then he went to his skipper on the 12 meter on the Nyala when Mr. Bedford got her. And then he got a couple of paid hands to go with him, and you know, a cook and a second crewman. But we used to bring most of the amateurs' crew down. They'd commute with us or meet us down there or something. He'd commute, come down, and he'd have his friends from up in Southport, who had a lot of, like Joe Watkins or his brother-in-law, what was his name, Jack Schott. He'd come down and sail with him on the 12, and we'd always get plenty of people that are willing to sail on 12s. It was a lot of fun in the bigger boats.
What were your impressions of the sixes and how they handled and?
Well, I liked them. I thought they were great little boats. They were very, very nice. They were fun to sail, and they weren't hard to sail, and they were good boats in the breeze, and they moved along at a pretty good pace. I thought they were wet boats. I mean, they were just open boats. We keep pumping the bilge out, keeping them dry, or keeping the water out of them. But on Long Island Sound, you didn't have too much wind most of the time. It was mostly light weather. But I thought they were a lot of fun. Holden Stevens was just coming along then as a designer, and then I think Rod sailed with me in a couple of races. And Rod was a good crew. Rod was awful good. Darn good. And then, of course, he got into ocean racing boats, and I think Owen came out with a boat of his a 6 meter one time, but I think called Natka, but I don't think she turned out to be so good for some reason. All the good boats he designed for other people.
Hmm. What were the major differences between, he designed Fun for you, is that right?
Yes.
And what was the major difference between that 6 meter and the Clinton Crane 6 meter?
He designed Fun actually for my father-in-law, Mr. Bedford. And he said, you sail the boat, I'll buy the boat, you sail it and see if you can get her on the team. Well, we got her on the team, all right, but she was supposed to be a Long Island Sound light weather boat, built for Long Island Sound conditions. And that's what he built the 12 meter for too, which was all right in light weather. She was a good light weather boat. But any time you got a breeze or other boats are a little more powerful and it would get by you. But we sailed her and got her on the team, and I don't know how we scored. We were usually busy trying to cover somebody else, but most of the boats that came over were fairly heavy weather boats from England anyway. They were used to sailing in more wind than we were, and we got a light weather day, which we get on the Sound, why we didn't have any trouble with them.
And you sailed in Prince of Wales races in Bermuda, is that right?
Oh, yes. We used to go down there in the spring. We'd take the boats down. We'd try to get a crew, a 6 meter team, to go down there in the spring and race their 6 meters. They had a class of one design anchor boats. which are very good boats, and they could really sail them, and they got some good real sails, some old man Tom Ratsey in Cowes, and they'd break them in very carefully in the old cotton sails, you know, and they were tough to beat. They'd usually beat us in the end. We might beat them once in a while, but I think they usually ended up with the cups. In the home waters, they were tough. They weren't quite so tough when we got them up on the Sound. We'd get them up there once in a while. Every few years, they'd come up and race with us. But some of them went to England with me, and I remember Kenneth Chimmingham sailed with me in England a couple of times, and we went over there with a 6-meter, sailed with me on the team over there. And those guys really knew their boats. They were very good. They just lived in them down there. Hmm. You know, they'd sail all year round, and they'd pretend that it wasn't too serious, but from the way they took it, you know darn well it was.
So they were tough competition.
Yeah, they tried to talk you out of anything. They were a bunch of good, great characters. They were always underestimating their abilities and stuff, you know. Oh, we never get any competition down here. We just sail amongst ourselves, have fun out there in the weekend, you know. But boy, they knew the rules and they knew everything else. They were awful good. We learned a lot from them.
Do you remember who else was sailing down there?
Well, let's see. There was a Eldon and Ken Trimmingham, they were usually together. And then maybe sometime they would sail separate boats, but usually they sailed together. Bayard Dill had a boat, and also one of the Bermuda One designs, 6 meters. Bayard Dill. I just can't think of the names of the other fellows. They all lived down Bermuda, the Bermudians, and good sailors.
Good sailors.
But Bayard Dill was a relation of Seward Johnson's. I think Seward Johnson married, his first wife was Bayard Dill's sister. You know, Johnson & Johnson, Seward Johnson. And he got very interested in 6 meters and started building them on his, and used to fly over. I remember he used to fly over from to Sewanica during race week or something, or he'd come over for weekend Saturday regatta if it was out at Sewanica. He'd fly over in a plane from where he lived in New Jersey. I think the factory, or he kept it right down on the river near where his plant was, I think. But anyway, he'd come over in this little plane and it would only hold a couple of people, so he'd go back, send it back again for his crew, and they'd go back again. Then they'd go home one at a time, back and forth, this ferry service. He ran his... I said, "Why the hell, Seward, don't you get a bigger plane and all come at the same time?" "Oh, no," he said, "this is a lot of fun. It's fine. It carries 4 people, and so forth and so on." I don't know. He had a pilot. I don't think he learned to fly it. I don't know.
Did Sis Hubby sail with you on occasion?
She sailed with me in Bermuda one time on Bermuda, on I think it was on, I guess it was on the Sixes or it was the One Designs. I've forgotten which. Yes, she did. She was a very good sailor, too. Very good. And let's see, what was the boy's name, the man's name from Marblehead who was down there? Charlie Welch, I guess, was from Marblehead. And he was down there one year with a 6-meter or barred one or something, or maybe we sailed on the Bermuda boats because we didn't have our own boats or something like that. And then Ray Hunt came down one year, and it got pretty popular. We used to go down there in the spring. They'd ship the boats down for nothing for us, take them on the foredeck of one of the queens, and give us a pretty good rate on our rooms and everything, and go down there. And I remember I had an awful cold one time I left, and I remember the steward said, "I know just what'll fix you up," and he gave me some sort of a drink, and I just about knocked me flat. I don't know what it was, but my God, by the time I got to Bermuda, I was over the cold. Whew! I think it was a lot of liquor in it. I don't know. Went to bed and went to sleep anyway, but It was an experience. I'd never had an experience like that before or since. Just what you want, I know. Just what you need. Must have been she's Scotch, I think. I don't know.
Did you do you remember what some of the other sailors thought of the fact that, well, your former wife or Sis Hubby were kind of a rarity competing among the men in international competition? Do you recall if they were accepted?
Yeah, they were. No, they were. They were good. They were good, just as good as the men. Sis, of course, sailed all her life out in Marblehead and had two brothers or three brothers and their father, and they all sailed. And she got into 30 squares, I think. And a boat of that type, which I never sailed. I never sailed up in Marblehead. We never got up in that area at all. We got tied up down Long Island Sound for some reason or other. Never made the transfer up there.
Did you ever sail with or against Lorna Whittlesey?
Don't remember it. I don't remember. Lorna, of course, was a terrific girl sailor. But I don't remember if she ever sailed. I don't remember her ever sailing any sixes, because Bill Luders was a damn good sailor, and he'd come over and bring Totem over sometime, or maybe one of the boats he designed, or somebody else's six-meter that he designed, come over and sail it and make sure she was going all right. But Bill Luders went to the same school I did, up to Hill School. And I knew him pretty well. And it's funny, and we lived in Connecticut, and I never got him to design a boat. We always went to Olin. We got Olin and Rod for some reason. They just sort of appealed to us, I think, and they always designed the boats that we had. Rod would sail once in a while, and I think in one of the Gold Cup races, it was the Gold Cup race or Sewanaka race that was over in Sewanaka. It was sort of at the end of the season, and I think they'd come off of, Rod had been sailing with, he'd just come off of Ranger, and Arthur Knapp with Mike Vanderbilt. They just won the America's Cup, and they came down, and I said, geez, I need some crew. Will you come with me? It's an awful come down. But he said, sure. So they jumped on there and went sailing with me on this darn thing against a British boat. I've forgotten what her name was, and we had a hell of a crew that year. Mm. Gosh.
How'd you do?
Did all right. I think we had trouble one year. I think we were sailing George Nichols' Goose. I was sailing, and he asked me to sail it for him or something. He wasn't too well. And I remember we had quite a lead over the Scottish boat, and it was a reach back to the finish line off Sewanaka. And like everything else, there wasn't much wind, and we were going along on the edge of the breeze. We thought it was, and then we thought, well, it'll probably come out of the south. And this guy was so far behind, he was so far, he knew he couldn't catch us any other way, so he took a tack and went up into not Glen Cove, but that other one on the other side of Oyster Bay, that harbor, towards in there in that neck, where the breeze used to come out of there for off the land first. Damn, sure enough, he got the breeze, by God, and we sat out there, and we weren't moving, and we couldn't get it, it didn't come, and he came all the way out with the breeze and went past us till he got right down with us had boat speed before we caught the breeze, and we couldn't catch him. I never felt so badly in my life as not letting him get uncovered like that. But he was so far behind, it was, you know, like 5 minutes behind. You thought, oh, hell, what the hell's the point of going way in there with him? He may not get the breeze either. We never get home tonight. But that was a very embarrassing moment for me. I'll never forget that. Rod was with me too. I said, Rod, boy, we'll never forget that. Live this one down. Lose the Sewanaka Cup. By God, he won the cup back, and that darn boat.
Well, that must have been a little unpleasant going back to shore.
Yeah, but you know, you get ahead. You got to keep between your boat and the mark. And I learned that lesson that time. I'll never forget that one. Stay between him and the mark. Of course, the trouble is, by the time he got to where we were, or had been, we drifted on a ways and were out of wind completely. And he had just enough breeze to get onto the starboard tack and go up into the shore. We didn't have any where we were. We couldn't have gone with it. It was too late. But if we'd have kept on his wind all the time and kept working the shore, not let him get in shore of us, we'd have been all right.
You had such good success in the Sewanaka Cup. Do you think maybe you were a little too relaxed at that point?
Well, we had the better boat. We were sure we had the better boat. But that Goose was a hell of a 6 meter. I think she was the greatest 6 meter hole I ever designed. I loved that boat, and George Nichols owned her and let me sail her once in a while in some of the races. She was a great all-around boat. It had the most beautiful mainsail. I think that helped it. I think she had the most beautiful mainsail I ever saw on the boat. It was just perfect. Oh, there wasn't a ripple in it, and it was just the right shape, and it just held its shape, and even if it breezed up, it would hold its shape. And just one of those combinations of a boat and a perfect sail.
Everything was right.
They were hard to get in those days, those sails, a really good sail. Boy, you had to work on them. You know, every week we'd go back to Ratsey and, you know, maybe change and tighten up a couple of seams or something like that. We were really trying for perfection. And, of course, the boat wasn't doing anything during the week, so we might as well have the sail down the loft. And if it got any salt on it, he'd wash it out and clean it up, and then I'd say, well, let's take it out there and stretch it out. We'd have a look at it and see if we could come up with some way to improve it.
So you did a lot of work on the sails that way?
Yeah, well, we did. Yeah. We did all during the week because the boat just lay at Larchmont. We had the two paid hands in the power boat. They could tow the boat down to City Island in a few minutes. Go down there and haul her out in Evans and where she was built and scrub her off or whatever we wanted done, you know. Was any point of just sitting in the harbor.
Mm-hmm. And then just take the sail over to Ratsey's?
Yeah, it was right next door. Take him over to Ratsey's and he wanted to improve on it. Or might make me maybe fussing around with a new type of spinnaker or something like that. Then we'd go out and have a look at it. And I'd run down in the car and meet him, and we'd go off City Island there and set it up and look at it and try it again. Hmm. But that was easy for him and just as easy for the paid hands because they lived on the boat anyway. Which, whether they had a mooring, and they didn't really care where they were overnight.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your 12-meter experiences, and you've mentioned a couple of things, but you sailed on owned, I think, a 12-meter called Canteto, is that how it's
called?
Canteto?
No, it was a chartered. We chartered her one summer. Yeah, I think my father-in-law chartered her. I mean, we went on a cruise, I think, with it. I don't remember too much about the boat. She was a European boat. It's a pretty good boat. And I think that was maybe the first 12. And then my father-in-law got more interested and built Nyala. And that was after Mike had built Fim. And then I sailed with Mike one. He got, Ron and I went over and sailed with him in Cow's Week and on Vim, and she let me sail her downwind because he liked to sail the boat upwind and make starts and stuff like that. And it was very tricky sailing over there. We had a local pilot, which I guess helped because you always had to either be up close to shore to get out of those terrible tides in the Solent, or you'd be close in shore and the guy who could get in the closest usually would win. And if you didn't hit a rock or go aground or something, if you did, while you're out of the race, probably you got stuck in the mud or something, or bounced off a rock or something. It was a very tricky sailing, and those guys knew the waters a lot better than we did, but we usually have a local pilot with us that would help, but sometimes you'd go too far trying to keep them covered. You knew they knew where they were going, but you were just far enough away there might have been a rock over here, but not over where he was, you know. It was fun. But we didn't take it too seriously. Hmm. And, of course, he took it all seriously. He was a stickler for rules, too. He had a very nice old steam yacht we all lived on. That was a lot of fun. And we go ashore in the morning, and he and Mrs. Vanderbilt and Rod and I would team up. We all have a couple of games of tennis in the morning and get some exercise and then come back and have lunch and go on the boat race.
Hmm. Was he an easy person to crew for, or...?
I guess so. I never had sailed with him until that summer, and I really don't know much about him, but I think he was fairly quiet, but I think he wanted his way, and he knew enough about it so that he was usually right. I don't remember anybody ever arguing with him about doing something, and I think Owen Rod might have if he was sure he was wrong, but I don't think he was ever quite, you could ever be quite sure that Mike wasn't right. And if it came to rules, forget it. I mean, if he wanted to make certain type of start, just let him alone and just keep your fingers crossed and hold your breath that you know, the other guy knew the rules or knew how to get out of the way if he didn't. I remember coming down the line a couple of times there on close haul on the starboard tack off cows, and they usually have a buoy and a dock or something, you know, and you had to go between these two, and it was hard to keep them in sight. They didn't have any mark boats or anything. But he came down the line there, and I thought, a couple of times, I thought, boy, we're awful close to being over. But, and then, what's his name? Who was that great English sailor that he was always racing against? The guy that had the Endeavors.
Oh, Lipton?
Not Lipton, no, that was Shamrocks. The other guy, you know, the ex-aircraft guy. Anyway, he had a 12, and he was pinching Mike coming down the line because he thought he was on the line. He thought Mike was over, but he didn't want to tell him he was. And he kept trying to squeeze him, and Mike kept hollering for room, you see. And he, I don't know, he had right in the world to holler for room. They were both on close haul on the starboard tack, and we had an overlap. We had to keep out of his way, as far as I could see. And Mike would get up there and say, give me some room, give me some room, give me some room. You don't have any right for room, Mike. You don't have any right for room. But it took his mind off I think it took the other guy's mind off steering the boat, because he'd only look back over his shoulder, you see. And the boat was sort of doing this. And Mike was just charging right down the line. He could see the line. But the guy protested us. We went into the protest meeting that night down in the Ryde Pier. It was a town meeting. And of course, all the great Vanderbilt, my God, he was been protested, and my God, the place was full of spectators. And I thought we're going to put on some sort of a show. It was a protest meeting. Gee, he got in there in this protest meeting, and he said, "Well, Mike didn't give me room in the line, and I had to bear off, and I think he fouled me." And the Vim, of course, was, I don't know whether you know what the name Vim meant in England. It was the type of stuff he used in the toilets to clean the toilet bowls out with. It was called Vim. And that was the name of Mike's boat. And all the spectators got tittering about this, the Vim, you see. And he said, we didn't know what they were laughing about, toilet bowl cleaner. And some of them said, well, that's not very nice. They think all our boats must be a bunch of toilet bowls that come over here and clean up on us with a Vim. A lot of remarks like that. But Mike got away with that one. I don't know how. I still don't think he was right.
Well, that was Sopwith. Is that right?
Tommy Sopwith?
Is that who that was?
I'm not sure that was Sopwith at that time, but it might have been.
Yeah.
It was either Sopwith or what's his name, Ferry, Dick Ferry, or one of the other good 12-meter sailors. Yeah, and Sopwith, the one I was thinking of. But I'm not sure that was Sopwith, but it might very well have been. Because they had quite a rivalry over there in the 12s that year. But that Vim was a tough boat.
Well, that must have been an interesting summer.
It was, because, of course, we just absolutely depended on our pilot for where to go in the waters, because we didn't have a clue whether how deep it was or where the rocks were. And this guy was knew almost where the rocks were, and he said, well, you better tack now because the rock over here just off your starboard bow or something like that. And we'd come about. It wasn't any good in throwing a lead line because you probably wouldn't hit the rock anyway. But...
Interesting.
She just didn't want to take it too seriously.
I read somewhere that you had a Garwood runabout, I guess, in the mid-20s.
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
wondered if, with your later interest in automobiles, if you had ever been tempted in the 20s or 30s to get into powerboat racing.
Yeah, I had. Living down in Mother rented a house in Greenwich that summer. And we were down there when I got out of school and went down there, and I got a regular Garwood runabout, because I wasn't too much in sailing at that time. I hadn't gotten into the starboats very much and stuff like that. So I loved any kind of cars and boats and powerboats. That was the first powerboat I ever had. And I remember watching the guys at night. They had Garwood had leased a barge, and he has these floodlights on the barge, all set up for night work on overhaul the boats and the engines and stuff at night. It was just as bright as daylight down there, tied up alongside a dock down in Greenwich Harbor. And I remember going down at night and walking out on the pier and watching all this going on. They had engines were out on stands and engines were going into the boat or coming out of the boat. Engines were apart over here in another section. And of course, it was just like broad daylight down there. And I was just intrigued. I thought, oh, this is something. And I stayed there for some hours watching them over all this engine put back in the boat. But I remember I took the Garwood up to New Haven to the boat races, Yale Harvard boat races. And I remember we went up and I had a couple of my roommates and a couple of girls with us. And then we were going to the Grizzle afterward, to the dance and have some dinner and stuff like that. And after the boat race, took some of those boats quite a while to get back out of the river because they had to wait for the bridge to go up. And we ducked out and, of course, we had a fast boat. We ducked out and we were going... Where was we? What started to go ashore somewhere, but I think I hit a rock somewhere. I was going to a wharf. I didn't know the place. I think I had a map in New London or something of the river going out of there. And we came back onto the bridge, and we were going up down towards the mouth of the harbor. And I remember we hit something, and the water started flooding into the bow of the boat. And I said, "Good God, we're taking on a lot of water, and I don't know whether I've even got a bilge pump here. We better just run her up on the beach." So we were right near the sub base, where they build the submarines up there at the time. Mm-hmm. I think there was a station up, the factory, I guess, where they were building them or something. Anyway, so I just turned and ran her up on the beach. And we got out, and the girls out, and the baggage out, and we were going to change our clothes at the hotel. We had rooms at the hotel and all that. And I said, "Well, you better get to..." The guard came down. I don't know what the hell we were doing. I said, "Well, we're sinking. Do you mind?" And I said, "I wanted to get ashore." And he said, "Well, you're not supposed to... This is government property." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry. There's the boat. I'm not going to take her out and sink her out there because I think we can save her if I get her beached up here and somebody come on and fix her." So anyway, they came up, and or somebody did in the City Island, the boatyard, and either patched her up or something, and we all, I think we called off the party. We all went home or got, I don't know what happened. The evening disintegrated after the boat races. But I remember went back in a couple of days and got the boat off, and somebody either put a patch over it or they put canvas over it or tacked it on or did something, and I remember running it back to City Island. They hauled it out down there and put another plank in, I guess, where it split it or cracked it or something. Hmm. But that's the only time I've ever come near sinking on a boat, I think. I don't know.
Did you?
Yeah, I thought, I love that Gold Cup. I remember watching the races and what's his name won it with, George Townsend, I think it was, in Greenwich. He won the Gold Cup that year off of Greenwich, which meant that I think that it would have been held there again the following year, although we didn't go back again the following summer. We had rented a house which was right opposite the Inn and Harbor Yacht Club across that little river there. And I remember seeing the yacht club across the way, and I didn't belong to it and didn't do much sailing or anything about it. I'd just go out and run around the powerboat like kids do now in their automobiles, I guess.
When did you start sailing in Atlantic?
Well, right after I got out of the starboats. I've forgotten what year it was, but they started to get we got into the class when they started the class. I've forgotten. There were some boats. I've forgotten the number of my boat now. But what the hell was it? I don't remember the number of it. But we got the class of boats. I think there were 10 or 12 boats up at the Southport, and I think I got one of them, and Spindrift, I think it was called, and I kept that boat right along, and I think she was painted red on the top sides. I remember the bronze bottom. I think it was number, well, I'll just take a guess. I think it was number 12, something like that. Hmm. I think we bought the first, the club signed up for the first so many boats, I think, of the class, where they came out with 70 or 80 boats or something, or 60 boats or something. And they went around to the various clubs and got them going on the sound.
And how long did you sail the Atlantic?
Well, I just sailed the Atlantic, of course, and then the kids came along, and they started in, and they got into, they didn't get into star boats much because they had their own little junior boats in those days, and they went from junior boats, and they used to come up and crew when I wasn't sailing a 6-meter. They'd get somebody to sail the Atlantic or something, and they'd go out and began to sail on the Atlantic. And sort of took her over, my boy did, and my son did, and we kept her there as, I don't know, a long time. I just had that one boat. Then I think then they came out with a class of fiberglass boats, so they fiberglassed them or did something, and I think I helped them organize that. And they got some new ones. They were fiberglass, or had them covered with fiberglass or something, and because they were getting pretty old and sort of long in the tooth. And I just sailed Atlantic about all the time till I moved away from there, really. Hmm. And 6 meters, because you'd have to go down the Sound for the 6-meter races. Mm-hmm. And then lots of times it'd be a Saturday race and no Sunday race. I'd sail the Atlantic up on our home port on Sunday.
So you sailed both sixes and Atlantic throughout the 30s?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, really. And then the kids, you know, got better and better, and then I'd let them sail, or they'd take the boat out maybe on Saturday, and I'd sail it Sunday or something like that. My daughter was very good, and my son was quite good. I think my daughter was better, but better skipper.
Hmm. And then what sort of sailing were you doing after the war and during the 1950s? Were you racing, or...?
Gee, I don't remember. The only sailing I've done was in Atlantic or the Sixes. And then when my father and I got the 12-meter, I used to go with him once in a while on the 12. And then, what was it? When was the cup races? 58? Mm-hmm. The first cup race, 58? I've forgotten. I think it was sailing Atlantics or Sixes until then. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten now exactly the years. And then we used to go on the cruises, of course, in the 12. And I got to go on the cruises, and we chartered a couple of 12-meters before we got our own, and went on a cruise. I think Canada we had one summer, and one of the other European 12s that had come over and cruised, and got to like them pretty well.
Hmm. Did you do any frostbiting at all?
No, never did any frostbiting. Mm-hmm.
Did you do any oath?
Well, I used to go to Florida in the wintertime. Uh-huh. So I was away all winter. I was down there. I was very busy playing tennis and golf and didn't do any sailing down there, but do a lot of fishing. And I was usually played golf every morning and tennis with my father-in-law, and he'd come down and I'd play golf in the morning and then I'd come play tennis in the afternoon. So that was practically 7 days a week. Hmm.
Did you get involved in ocean racing at all, or did that appeal to you? Or?
No, went on one Bermuda race after I got the schooner, you got up Mystic.
Brilliant.
After I bought Brilliant, we went on. I took her on a. We got her. She was after the war. She came out of the war and she was all painted gray, you know, and a messy looking thing. Somebody in Detroit had bought her, and I got Jake to buy her to see if he'd want to sell her, and he decided he'd sell her because he's going to have a big job on cleaning her all up and scraping her down and getting her back into shape. So he sold her to me. I think I got her for $15,000. I bought her from him. God knows what he paid the government for it, probably five. But anyway, that's fine. I love the boat, and I always thought I saw her being built, and I thought, boy, that's the best-built boat I've ever seen. Hmm. There's no way that they can, because she was built down in Evans in the Depression, and he wanted to keep as many men as he could, but he naturally would keep his best men first, most of the head guys, and they are all the ones that built that boat. There are hardly any helpers there because there wasn't enough work for them. Hmm. And they did, and what's his name, he used to come down from, he was stationed up at the base, up at the sub base, in not Mystic, but In Groton, I guess, where the sub base is. Mm-hmm. And he was an engineer. What's his name? The owner.
No, I forget.
Now, yeah, well, anyway. So he'd come down every weekend, come home every weekend, and go and inspect the boat. They'd show him every piece of lumber that went in there. If it had anything that wasn't right, he'd say, no, I don't want that piece. I don't want that piece. He picked out every single damn piece of everything that went into that boat himself. It's incredible. And they took all the time in the world because they had nothing else to do. So they'd wait for him, you know, and there was no hurry. And it took about twice as long to build it as they'd build an ordinary boat, I'm sure. And he had that. The only trouble was he put that horrible gasoline engine down there under the bilge with a tank of gas on top of it, with a gasoline tank on it. And it was, or under the gas, no, the gasoline tank made the thing on top of which the engine sat. And that was, the gasoline tank was all welded and fitted in between all the frames. Very intricate welding. And a beautiful job of making this gas tank up. And it went right down in the bilge. So it went right down like this. And on top of the keel. And then they had a little Chrysler engine sat on top of that. So that was all right for a while. And I got sort of fed up with it. And we changed it to, a diesel in there, didn't we, or something? I think we put a diesel in there. It's probably still in there now. Good God knows. But I was always afraid of with the kids. I have a lot of kids out or take them out for weekends or sail. I thought, well, geez, you know, maybe a fire or some darn thing on this darn gasoline. So we switched it over. But that was, without a doubt, the wood and the stuff in that boat is absolutely handpicked by old Mr. What's-His-Name himself.
How did you happen to be aware that Brilliant was being built at that time? Or?
Well, I used to go down there once in a while and see her being built. Down in Evans. It was the only boat he had being built, you know, and every once in a while I'd get some time off or something when I was up there, and I was down on this damn airplane patrol thing down in Florida during some of the war, the latter part of the war, this anti-submarine patrol up and down the coast where they had it, and they had it from Maine down right around to through the Gulf Coast and around with these small planes, and we had 40 miles of waterfront to cover between our group and the next group, so my sister-in-law had built a little, or gotten involved in flying, and got a little seaplane base going down in Westport on the Saugatuck River. And I'd learned to fly down there, and on both land and water. I learned to fly in Florida and land, and then got my water certificate up in Connecticut on floats. And so I was down there in the wintertime, or most all year round, till that was over. When that was over, of course, then all this stuff became available. But I don't know why that, but I just said if I ever have a chance, I'll buy that boat someday. And I went in the Bermuda race. I wanted to go in that one time. And Rod went with me. I don't know whether Olin went or not. I've forgotten now. We didn't do too well. We had it light weather, and it was on the nose all the way down. I think we must have gone to Europe and back in order to tack down to Bermuda, because it was just hard on the wind all the way and no wind at all. We had a Genoa jib up and all our light sails. This poor heavy weather world cruising boat was slugging along at about 3 knots. Oh my God, what a beautiful trip we had. But oh, and I had what's his name with me, that the guy that went around the world so many times and took those. What was his name? He was with me on the boat. He was the skipper on the other watch. Oh, you know, the famous guy. He's written all kinds of books.
Irving Johnson?
Irving Johnson. Yeah, he was with us on that cruise, that Bermuda race. I bet we covered more miles than any boat in any Bermuda race ever covered, I think. Gosh. It was just absolutely heartbreaking to see that day after day, just light weather, you know, 8-10 mile breeze, just about enough to fill the sails. And that poor old thing wasn't going anywhere very fast. I think we got in there about 3 days after everybody else finished. Oh, well.
Well, as you're well aware, she's doing fine. And
yeah, I believe she is.
Yeah.
Geez, I hope they can keep that up. I hope they can make it go of that thing, because I think there's a lot of kids get... I mean, I think it's wonderful to be able to take these people out on that boat, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And...
give them an idea what a really good boat is.
It's a great experience, and the skipper now, George Moffat, is excellent.
Yeah, done a wonderful job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great tradition.
Yeah.
Nice boat, and it's a nice program.
Well, I bet the kids get a lot of kick out of it, and I hope they appreciate it.
Oh, sure.
She's done very well, too. I guess she cleaned up in Maine the other last year. Was it last year, the year before?
Yeah, came back with quite a load of silver.
And then she won that race down in New York, in the harbor down there.
Yeah.
Well, so that was one of those beautiful boat. There was a beautiful model built of her. A fella built a model of my 6-meter. I've forgotten his name now. He was about the best model builder Olin knew at the time. And he'd sailed on her. He built a model of her, and it went to Mr. Bartram's, son, the owner's son. He got it when his father died.
Hmm.
And it was up for sale one time, and I was tempted to buy it, but he was asking $50,000 or something for it.
Hmm.
And I thought, oh, geez, I can't afford that. I just look at a model boat. And I said, I paid $5,000 for the boat. I can't give $50,000 for the model. It was down at the New York Yacht Club for quite a while. That some reason or other, they had to move it, or they didn't have room for it, or something. And it came up for sale, and I remember calling, up in Mystic, the skipper, and he used to be skipper on the boat. Lives up there.
Captain Bowker?
Yeah. And I said, geez, you think you ought to get that? Can you get it? And he said, geez, somebody give us the money, we get it. I'd love to have it, but I said, gee, see if you can't get somebody to get it, because I can't think of the name of the guy. The name that built that was one of the best model makers, I think, in the East Coast.
Hmm.
Did a beautiful job on it, full rig model in the case. But he did one of my 6-meter, which I've got. I haven't unpacked it yet, but I'm going to stick it where this silly little sailing model goes in front of the fireplace. But I've got it in a carrying case because it's pretty delicate. I think I got one busted shroud in there, but no, that was a great boat. Biff still lives around there, doesn't he?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Doesn't he have something to do with the library?
Yeah. Well, he's working as a consultant for the curatorial department.
Oh, is he?
So, in fact, my office is in the library, and
I see
him in there a lot.
He's
in there doing research and helping out, and he's quite a character. He's a
getting letters. I get letters all the time from you people and telling me what's going on and stuff like that. And evidently that, God, things haven't been going too well there lately. And I hope to God they can keep it going.
Yeah, I hope they've things
had to
let, pick up a
they've
little
had
bit.
To cut down on their help and everything, which is tough because you need people around to explain about all this thing. When people get in there, they just wander around and miss half of the show.
Yeah. I think it's just... You know, a temporary.
Well, didn't somebody start something like this down in Norwalk? Wasn't it sort of a competitor?
Yeah, but that hasn't really amounted to much.
It hasn't gone over. I didn't know we're drawing stuff from you people.
No.
The trouble is, you get on that damn freeway to go somewhere, and you want to get there, and you don't unless you make a special day to go to Mystic. You can't really see it. And then they put didn't they put a thing out there with those live fish in it right on the freeway?
Right, the aquarium, yeah.
The aquarium, which has probably taken visitors that just want to stop and get a hamburger or something and look at the fish for half an hour or go to the lavatory or something.
But the biggest problem has been that tourism is down throughout the Northeast.
Is it really?
Yeah, all the other museums and Cape Cod, all the businesses on Cape Cod. So it's more of a regional problem.
Yeah,
apparently.
I see.
And... But
Sturbridge Village and
Sturbridge
all that,
Village has been way down also, So it's apparently there's more of a recession, at least in that area, than anybody has formerly.
I wonder where those people are going, or what people that just aren't going around, I guess.
Not as much.
Of course, the roads are getting more crowded, which makes it less pleasant to drive, I'll admit, because I hate to drive up on these freeways now. I'm supposed to go to a dentist and stuff, and he lives up in Newport Beach where we used to live. And I've always been to him, and he's a good dentist, but he said, it's time for your checkup, and God, I just hate the thought of dragging my ass out there and going in that mess. You never know when you're going to get into a thing and sit there for 2 hours, like clear up a half a dozen cars that are all tangled up.
I lived in Los Angeles for 2 years, and I left about 11 years ago, and this trip back here has been the first time since then, and I... I got on the freeways a few days ago, and it took me about 10 seconds to remind me why I went back east. It just is, boy.
Well, it's a funny thing, because my wife's, she has three sons. One of them died, and they were twins, and the other one was living in Costa Mesa. He's working for the telephone company. He'd been there for years. He had a good job there and so forth, but he couldn't get trained. And then when we moved down here, she said, well, would you like to come down here? And they said, well, that would be nice, because there'd be less traffic and all this sort of thing. But then he had to commute, and he used to have to leave at 5 o'clock in the morning to get up there in time to go to work. And then he'd get home God knows what time in the evening. And because he was sort of in a job that didn't have any time involved with it. I mean, he was on call a lot. So they just got fed up with it and finally moved to Florida. And so the other boy lives here. The third son lives here now, and he's got some back trouble. He's going to have to change his job. He used to love to prune trees, and he was very good at it. And he hurt his back somehow, and now he does it, and it twists some nerve in his back, and he's got to lay off for a while, so he's got to find something else to do. But they just love it down in Florida. They say it's absolutely different than it is around here. It's so much more low-key. And older people, and they're retired, a lot of them. They're over in Naples on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. And he loves to fish. And he's got a job down there with a phone company. And he's stringing wire out. And he said, God, I'm out there in the swamp with the alligators, and it's more fun. He said, I love wild animals anyway. And they're just having a ball down there. And the little girl, his girl's going to school. She made the honor roll, got straight A's. She said, everybody's so relaxed and laid back and peaceful and quiet and polite and everything, and nobody's pushing anybody out here.
Well, it seems fairly relaxed here, with the exception of the freeways. The freeways and the traffic are really something. But aside from that,
unless you want to go back country, that's the way you got to go.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you have to go to Newport Beach or something where you used to live, it's just, I used to make an appointment and make it about 3 to 4 hours later than I was hoping to get there. And then I'd get up there and sit for an hour in the parking lot.
But you had to do that just
to
be sure. You
had to make sure I didn't miss it. I missed it a couple of times and was late. Hmm. And then, you know, you can't hold them up, and they've got other appointments.
So. I wanted to ask you a little bit about Columbia in 1958. That was, and your feelings about that experience.
Well, it was great to do it. And appreciate it very much. They asked me if I knew Harry Sears not too well. I knew him slightly, and I didn't know. I knew some of the other fellows in the thing, but I don't know why they picked on me. They want to know if I want to join the syndicate, and I said, well, I can't afford to put in a lot of money, but I put in a few $1,000 on the syndicate, and I'd like to help out if I could. And they said, well, how about sailing the boat? And I said, well, that's something else again. I'd love to do that, but I don't know how much experience I've had except for sailing Nyala on 12-meters, and I haven't done much sailing lately. And anyway, it worked out all right, but of course we had both Olin and Rod there. We had a hell of a good crew. And I got Mike's old skipper on there. He was the head of the paid hand, and we were allowed three paid hands anyway, so we had those three boys on there, and they were, I've forgotten what Mike Skipper's name was. God, he'd had him for years, and he was on the 12-meter with him, and on the Vara, and all the other boats and power boats and stuff, and lived right there in Newport. But it was a big thing, and we had some tough competition. God, guys like Arthur Knapp were pretty tough, even though the boat might not have been quite as good. I think we had the better boat. I'm glad we finally came out in the end, because I think we did have a little bit faster boat. I think Weatherly was a better boat after they put more lead in her and made her, and Bus took her over and won the cup with her. She was a better all-round boat, and especially in heavy weather. She used to just get a good, nice sailing breeze, and she'd just lay over on her side when we were sailing against her, and she looked pretty light with her. But poor old Hubby's with her. That boat of, he was a big boat, big powerful boat, but we never got that much kind of breeze. Mm. We had one hell of a good race with him one time. It was a close reach all the way up to Seconnet and back. I think it was called Seconnet. There's a buoy up, way up off down the sound there somewhere. down back east. And we had a close reach up there and a close reach back, and for one of our elimination races or something, and we started Sheets. And, boy, we just barely kept ahead of him all the way out there and back, and it was a tough battle. But Rod was awful good on the boat and getting his boat trimmed just right, you know, and we had a hell of a crew.
How did that experience compare to some of your 6-meter sailing and that
sort of thing? Oh, well, I think it was a lot bigger thrill, you know, with the America's Cup. I mean, that is the end all of the sailing when you come down to it, or it used to be. I don't know what has deteriorated now since this last fiasco, but I think it'll pick up again. I understand there's already one boat, and I think it's been built in Italy, and it's under sail already on the new rule, which should be quite an interesting boat, I think. Both about the size of the maxi boats, and much better in light weather, much more sail, and more tender, but much better for general all-around sailing than the maxi boat. They'll still have a big crew on them, but I don't think you have any trouble getting crews for these boats.
So are you optimistic that the event will bounce back and get straightened out? And
oh, I don't know. I haven't thought much about it. It's too bad it got where it got. I don't know what this bunch of lawyers up there in New York got to make a decision. It's pretty soon. I thought it was supposed to be in March, but this is already April. So it's any day now they got to come out whether the cup is going to be given back to New Zealand or we're going to keep it. I don't know. But no matter where it goes, I think it's going to attract a lot of attention. Because I know that from what I've read, there's at least two Japanese that are building boats. How good they'll be, I don't know. But those guys work at something, and they can get pretty good at it. Hmm. And I understood the Russians had finally got together, a bunch of them, and were going to build a boat. And they've had some good sailors come out of Russia. They've won starboat international races and stuff like that. And I think if you can sail small boats, you can sail a big boat. There isn't that much difference at all. I mean, you've got to concentrate more, I think, on a sailboat, on a small boat, because it's so much, it moves around so much quicker and easier that you've got to follow the wind than a bigger boat. You can't sail it like a little boat, but you've got to be on the edge of the wind all the time. And if you concentrate on it, it's easier to keep it full and going. But, of course, a lot depends on your crew in a big boat. It all depends on the crew. If you have a better crew and the boats are fairly equal hull-wise, but you make a mess out of a jibe or spinnaker down or a jibe or something like that, or rounding a mark and get the damn spinnaker under the bow of the boat or something, why, that's practically the end of a 12-meter race right there. They're getting pretty close to within a few seconds of each other.
What do you think of the expense aspects of big boat racing, America's Cup?
It's just getting fantastic.
And the commercialism really now where you get the corporate
sponsors. Oh, I know.
Sponsors.
And I'm afraid you're going to see signs on the sails and signs on the boats. And on this new boat, I saw pictures of her the other day, and she had the name of somebody written right, great big letters down the side, so-and-so's beer or something like that, you know. And, it's gonna look like hell, I think. But I guess you get used to it. You've got to reply. Somebody's got to put up the money for these things, and if you can't get these corporations to put up the money, I don't think the people are going to do it. There's not that many people around with that kind of money anymore that want to do that sort of thing.
In what ways do you think sailing was maybe better in say the 20s and the 30s? What aspects of it were maybe better then than they might be now?
Well, of course, I don't know. I've been out of sailing for quite a while. I mean, I don't know. I've had power boats when I lived up in Newport Beach. I had a couple of sailing boats, but there's always a little bit of trouble maybe getting a crew or something. When my wife liked the power boat, we'd just go over to Catalina Island or something like that. There was no point of having a sailboat. But I don't know. I wouldn't like to say because I just haven't done much lately. But I don't know. America's Cup has got its own. I don't know. If it goes back to New Zealand, I don't know what'll happen. Of course, they'll challenge New Zealand for it. They'll have to have sail off, which boat's going to go down there, whether they're going to drag them all down to New Zealand, whether they can I don't know whether they can put all those kind of boats up or build. It's getting so expensive to build all the shore stuff you need for these boats. Yeah, each one has its own sail loft. My God, they've got hauling out and sail loft, and it's a terrible thing. You've probably read about Alan Bond, haven't you, in the papers once in a while?
Yeah.
Well, he got in trouble with that painting he bought and loaned half the money to him from the. That's the darnest thing I ever heard.
Yeah.
The Sotheby's loaned him half of the sale price of the picture.
And I guess they're not going to be doing that again.
Jeez, is that the funny? That's the damnest. I never heard of anything like that. He never paid for the damn thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was unusual too. That was just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I know. Well, it all came out in a wash. But I guess things haven't been going too well with him, and he's way over. He's all on the cuff, I guess. I don't know.
What do you think makes a good racing skipper?
A good racing skipper?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's probably just like anything else. Probably no different than a good golf player. You might have to be a little more athletic as a golfer, but I think you just got to dedicate yourself to it. Take a guy like Arthur Knapp, and he could sail most any boat. Give him a chance to practice a little, and he'd get the best out of the boat. And they've just studied it and done it all their life. I don't. I think it's just attention to details, attention to small details, and stuff like that. But then again, maybe golf. You may have more of an athletic ability, I suppose, it would go into golf than you would have to be in a skipper. You don't have to be an athlete to sail a boat. But I think you've got to have a very strong. I think you must love details. You're always fussing about something or other, whether this winch should be moved 6 inches over this way. You could tack quicker than it was where it is. It wasn't just right, or some darn thing. Or how do you improve this, or how do we improve that? They've got the 12s down. And of course, the 12s, all the boats will come the same way. They get them rigged pretty soon, and that's it. There won't be much you can do about changing them, make them any better.
Hmm.
I think the guys that design these boats now know enough about them to come up pretty much with a start. I don't think he'll change much on it. We never change much on the 12s. And maybe think of a better way to jibe a boat or something like that, or get a spinnaker in without having it get under the bow or something.
Were you an easy person to crew for when you were?
I don't know. Don't ask me. No, I think I had a bit of a temper. I think God, if I saw something that wasn't right, I'd let them know real fast. Or if it wasn't trimmed right, I'd say, well, come on, now watch that sail. Watch the sail. I used to spend most of the time, of course, watching, keeping my sails on the wind. You had to just keep on the edge all the time. And then trying to, with my wife, she was either the main sheet man and backstay man. She was in the cockpit with me aft. And then the two pan hands were in the forward cockpit, but she was always watching where the other boats were and what the story was in case they should tack or getting a better breeze or there was more breeze somewhere, something like that. I was just more or less concentrating on getting the best out of my own boat. And somebody else was doing the looking around for weather and everything else and what was going on.
So you think you were pretty focused and pretty intense on your...
Yeah. Yeah, I was. No, I'd get pretty wrapped up in the thing. I used to play a lot of golf, too. I loved to play golf. We'd play golf in the morning before we go sailing, usually. I used to play golf every day. And, I finally got a hole in one, which I suppose is everybody's trying to do. And it was, luckily it came when we were playing with our wives on one of those mixed foursome things where you played best ball to the... Each had one shot to the green, and then you took the best ball from there, took turns until you went in the hole. This was on a short hole at the home club, and the green is raised above the tee, and we each drove off, and the other two couple drove off. They drove, and it wasn't a draw, it was an iron shot. I've forgotten what a club I used. We went up to the green and saw one ball. And I said, well, no, we saw three balls, but I said, my God, where the hell is my ball? I know I hit the green. We looked around, we looked all around. We never thought to look in a hole, you know. I said, well, it must be around here. Well, okay, play your ball, I'll play your ball then. So I played her ball. I've forgotten whether it was my turn or not, but we had to do something. It was every other shot. I think you drove, and then you picked the best drive and played every other one from there. So anyway, we went to get the ball out of the hole, and there was my ball in the hole. I said, my God, I had a hole in one. Take it back.
The last place you would have thought to look.
Well, I never thought it was a raised green. I couldn't see the hole. I mean, I could see the flagpole, but I had no clue how far back it was. It's just absolutely blind. I might as well have shut my eyes and hit it. Probably could have gone the hole the same way. But I'll never forget that. I said, well, this game's pretty damn easy when you could shut your eyes and get a hole in one. No, there's all those little things. Arthur used to be very good at that, and of course Rod was terribly good at that too, and make sure everything was square on the boat, whether there was a cleat that was coming loose or a screw that was out of place, or, you know, he's always checking over everything on the boat, all the rigging and all that, because of course that's what keeps him getting into trouble. Any frayed wire or something like that, you know, in the sheets or something.
I had a list of a few people here, and I wanted to just ask you for your impressions of them. Yeah. And one would be Sherman Hoyt.
Well, Sherman, I thought, was one of our top sailors. Of course, when I got to know him, he was getting older. And Sherman did used to drink a lot. And I remember during Larchmont Race Week, he'd be pretty well along before the race ever started, you know. But he could get away with it. And he just had so much experience that... And he was very good at getting the best out of a boat. I thought Sherman really was one of our great sailors. Mm. And maybe in his later years, he was going on his reputation, but I mean going on what he'd learned. He'd been doing the same thing so long in his life that he could sail any boat. You get him on an ocean racing boat and give him the helm, and he'd get the best out of the boat. He'd get the sails trimmed the way he thought they should be, and they were right. And then he'd get the best speed out. That speed would always go up.
Hmm. Corny Shields?
Shields was another one, like Sherman, only Corny was sober. And I don't remember ever seeing Corny drink. And he was terribly good at picking his weather and going to the right spot. And, of course, he lived on the Sound and raced a lot on the Sound. Now, when you got him outside of the Sound, I don't know whether he was any better than some other guys. On some of the cruises I've been on and stuff like that, where he sailed a boat, I've never noticed that he was getting any more out of it than maybe somebody else. But when you get him in his own waters, he was pretty hard to beat in his own boat. Hmm. And he knew how to tune a boat. I think he probably knew how to tune a boat. Maybe he was more fussy with that than Sherman was. But Sherman just had the feel of a boat. I guess Corny had the same thing. It was a natural with them. They knew by the feel whether the boat was really going right or not.
Clinton Crane?
Well, I never sailed much with Clinton Crane. He was a damn good designer, but I never sailed with him to know. He never sailed with me enough to know whether much about his sailing ability. I think he probably was a very good sailor in his youth, but he didn't get the chance much as later on. He was pretty busy in his design office and got into powerboats and stuff like that, and didn't have the chance to get out on the boats the way Olin and Rod did, sailing them and trying them out and testing them in different size boats, ocean racing boats, 6 meters, 12 meters, 8 meters.
He seems to have been pretty accomplished for somebody who was really doing design work and everything as an amateur and had a full-time
career.
Yeah,
well, I think he was an amateur in as much as that wasn't his main job. Mm-hmm. But I think he was probably as good a designer as we had professionally. I think he was in the same class as any of our professional designers, really. And then, of course, he did some power boats, which you don't think about much. Mm. Big boats, you know, yachts and stuff like that. People don't hear about it. It belonged to so-and-so, and you see a picture of him, and that's all you ever hear about the boat. I don't know how she went to sea or whether she was a good boat to sea or not. Mm. Most of the people that had them didn't know anything about it either.
And Philip J. Roosevelt?
Phil Roosevelt, I didn't know Phil too well. He was very good. Of course, he did terribly well with Mistress, with his schooner. And I don't know, in the smaller boats, I don't think he was probably quite as attentive and quite as, had quite as fine a touch on the helm as maybe Bill Luders or Arthur Knapp or Sherman Hoyt or some of those chaps, because they were used to sailing small boats a lot. Mm-hmm. And Phil was, he'd done more cruising. And I think he was probably a good... going across the ocean, he'd probably get better sights maybe than some of the guys that didn't. He had more experience in that than some of these other boys. But to race against, he never, I never had any fear of him beating me or worried about him at all. And he was just another sailor.
And Swede Whiten?
Swede Whiten was sort of an enigma. I always thought Swede could be very good or very bad. And he had times when he seemed to go off the deep end and just do the dumbest thing I'd ever thought he would. Why did you do that? And then other times he was very good. I think he had a good feel of a boat. And as much as once he got aboard, getting the mess out of her, maybe he wasn't quite in the class of As I suppose Sherman. I don't think he had quite the experience that Sherman had and some of those other fellows that were in some pretty hot classes. And Gorney Shields was a pretty hot class of boats on those interclubs, the internationals. They had some pretty good sailors in there, like Bus Mosbacher and some of those guys. They were awfully good. I never knew Swede too well. I mean, he lived in Oyster Bay and I didn't live over there, and I honestly didn't know him too well. I certainly don't want to say anything against him.
Okay. You've talked some about Rod and Olin Stevens, and just wanted to ask you about your impressions of them.
Well, I've known them quite well for a long time. I've always thought Olin was tops as far as I was concerned, as far as a designer of most any kind of a boat. In other words, if I was going to get a boat designed, he's the guy I'd like to have do it. But that may have been just because I've seen an awful lot of good boats that he's built or designed and sailed with him. He's very quiet, and I don't know whether he's up on his racing tactics as much as Pepe Rod is, and probably not as much as maybe Corny and Sherman in a big class of boats, in one design class or something like that, because that's pretty tough. You got to take advantage of everything to beat a bunch of boats which are exactly the same design as yours and same sails and everything and sailed by some pretty good people. But Rod, I think, could get the best out of a boat I've ever known and get the feel of a boat when she was moving at her best, under reaching or on the wind or whatnot, and trimming the sails and playing around with them and stuff like that. But I saw a lot of them that one summer, of course. We were on the 12, and that's really the only... I've never been on much of a time when he was on long-distance cruising races with him. I've never been on a race with Rod, so I don't know, but I understand he's... From what everybody else says, he's just tops. And keeping the rigging, especially good at rigging and making sure that there's nothing going wrong with it or how to repair it, if it try to come up with a jury rig to fix it so that you don't have to drop out of the race or something, you know. He's very, very good at that. But, of course, Rod was very good. I think he was a good boat builder. I think he had a lot to do with building some of the boats, actual working on them, you know. And I think he practically built his own boats over there at Minifords. His father paid for him, but I think Rod had put an awful lot of his own effort into the actual construction himself. So he knew the whole thing, from building them to keeping them up and taking care of them.
Do you have a single favorite boat of all the boats that you've sailed or been associated with? Or?
No, I don't know. I think 6 meters, I think it would be Lulu. But that was just because we did well with her, I think. But I think certainly cruising boats would have been, boat up in Mystic there.
Brilliant.
Brilliant, yeah. But I never did much cruising with her, unfortunately. I never took the time. I didn't like cruising that well, just going on long cruising races. It wasn't my cup of tea at all. Mm. I was sort of a short round of buoys and then go home, play some golf. Go flying or do something, drive a car somewhere or something. No, I don't think I'd have gone in for the long distance cruising or long. Yacht club cruise was all right. It was kind of fun, but nobody took it too seriously, I don't think.
What were the most satisfying aspects or experiences in your sailing career? What is it that you've enjoyed most or gotten the most out of from sailing?
Well, I think sailing the 6 meters on the teams and the various team races with Europe or with England or Scotland or something like that. In those days it was, and Bermuda, taking the boat around and going with other countries and seeing how they sailed. And then, of course, I think the greatest thrill was winning the America's Cup, of course. But unfortunately, we didn't have much competition. I mean, I think we'd appreciated it more if we'd had been up against a tougher competitor and had a hard time to beat him, but it was so one-sided, it wasn't much fun. Mm. It just wasn't like a race. You know, you beat somebody by minutes, it's just terrible. Took all the fun out of it. You felt sorry for him, really.
Well, at least it's better than losing by minutes.
Oh, yeah, no, that's right. I just felt sorry that they had to lose by that because I couldn't see how the boat could have been that much worse than our boat. Mm. So whether it was they didn't sail her right or what, I don't know. But, gee, the guy that designed her was a good designer, and he designed some good 12 meters. And I didn't see how she could have been so bad. Designed some good 6 meters. But they certainly didn't get the best out of her, or she was a dog.
So that took a little bit away from it, the fact that they didn't...
Oh, it was. The starts weren't much fun. You didn't really matter where you started, You knew you'd beat the guy the first mark. And if he ever got on your wind, you'd just sail right through him. And it took all that sort of thrill out of trying to match wits against somebody in another boat, like a one-design boat, where you knew the other guy was both just as good as yours, and you had to outwit him some way and get him all crossed up at the start. But, gee, we made some poor starts. I don't know. It just wasn't... We didn't want to be over the line early. That's the only thing we cared about. Didn't seem to matter how late we were. We knew we'd pass the guy before we got to the first mark. It was... I don't know. We got all keyed up for this terrific match that was coming up. It was such a letdown. I think some of the 6 meter races we had were a lot of fun, especially the team races, because you were trying to keep some guy covered and help somebody else over here who was having a tough battle with somebody else, and seeing if you couldn't outwit him or something.
Well, you had with the 6 meter, with the international competition, you had the international competition.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of an interesting dimension, different than say Larchmont Race Week or something. Where
that's true.
Fun,
yeah, well, it was because you never know what kind of boats you're going to be up against. Sometimes they were pretty damn good boats, and the Scandinavian Gold Cup was a tough one. You had to win three of those. The first guy that won 2-3 races was the winner, and you get a whole bunch of guys to start with, and then you eliminated all but the first three. I think that's the way it was, as I remember right. And then the three raced together. Well, gee, if you won one race, that was one to your... All you had to do was win two more. But you had two guys against you. And they were each determined one of them was going to beat you, so to give them a chance to win. So it was kind of fun that way.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Was there anything else that we haven't talked about that we should have?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I've shut my mouth off here so long.
anything that you'd like to put on the record here for
posterity? No, I don't think so. I don't think so, gee. If anybody else read this tape, Sherman or some of those guys. Well, Sherman's gone, of course, so is Corny. But no, it was a great having those older fellows there when I was learning, I think, because you learn a lot quicker from somebody like that after you get beaten a few times by him, you know. And it sharpens you up real quick.
Were they pretty willing, people like Sherman and Kearney Shields, to help the younger sailors?
Oh, I think they were. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd ask for it. They wouldn't go out of their way to tell you. And lots of times they had ideas about starting or something where it was better to do so-and-so than such-and-such. And they might not give that away. They tried to keep some of their, which they thought they knew maybe the other guys didn't know. They wouldn't give you their tricky stuff out. But you catch on to it pretty quick after they pull it on you once or twice. You realize what was going on, and then you learn. But you learn the hard way, and you probably do you a lot more good. But they were always very friendly about it and stuff like that. Or they'd say, well, gee, we had a, you know, we got a better light weather boat than you had, or you had the wrong sail on today or something. It looked a little tight on a leech or something, you know. But they were so good at spotting errors in other boats and sails, and so good at picking out the ones that were really right for the conditions, that you learned a lot that way. And if they tell you that, you know, what was the matter with my boat today, Corny? I couldn't seem to point my boat with you at all today. And he said, well, I think you had your jib trim too flat, and I think it just killed the boat, or something like that, or it was backing your mainsail too much, or something to that effect, you know. And maybe you didn't notice it yourself because, you know, you thought, well, the tighter I trim this thing, the better I ought to go to windward. But you get to a point of no return where you can't. The boat won't do it.
It's really something to think about, the competition in the 6 meters or in the other, you know, the other classes. But just some of the names and some of the people involved, just wonderful competition.
Yeah.
Yourself and the other people that we've mentioned.
Of course, I think the one design class was probably better competition. You learned faster than you did in an open class like a 6 meter, because you didn't know when the boat came out how good the boat was to start with. And you took a part of the summer to find out whether the boat was a good reaching boat, but she didn't go to windward too well, or she did running, or she off the wind she was better than on the wind, or vice versa. Whereas a one design boat, they were so close to being the same that maybe just a little bit of trim here and there would have made the difference between winning and losing. And the sails were there. They tried to make them, you know, you tried to get your sails from the one design class. They were all cut at the same time, and they tried to make them as near one design as possible. Now, the interclubs, the national internationals, which Corny sailed so much and had so much to do with keeping the class going, they're only allowed one suit of sails a year, or one suit every other year. They're only allowed to buy one sail. So they had to make the best out of that sail that they had, and they had to keep it for a year and get beaten all that time. So they'd take it down, try to get it recut and reshaped or something like that, but it probably was maybe do more of the way the guy trimmed it than it was the actual sail itself. But you just 6 meters, just if you didn't like the jib, you just went and bought another jib. You didn't waste time fooling around with the old one. You just junked it or used it for practice or something. But there was, you weren't limited to what you could have in the way of sail area or sail, how many sails you could have of one kind, or try a different shape on the spinnaker. Somebody was always coming up with a different idea. Ratsy was trying to get you to try something. He'd try something else because it meant he could sell some more spinnakers, you see. So I would make a little fuller in the head this time and see if he could keep it full. See if it's any good on a reach or not. No, it's no good on a reach. Just dead before. We have to change it.
When you were competing in Europe, did you have to be real careful that you had all the sails that you needed before you went over?
Well, you hoped you took the ones you wanted. Usually you took a heavier weather sail than you did. Usually it was more breeze over there than it was that we had. You could pretty much count on it. In other words, if there had so much tide in the Solent that if you had light weather, you probably wouldn't get around the course, because the tide would just take you out of the, take you right, sweep you right out of the Solent until the tide turned and brought you back the other way. We had that one time with the 12-meter. We were going along with Mike there on the 12-meter. We weren't going over the ground at all. We had a spinnaker on, the main sheet drawing, and we were doing about 5 or 6 knots. But we were right in the wrong, in the damn rip. We didn't know it at the time. We were just sat there, looked dumb, fat, and happy, and boat not moving. Sails all full. We said, this is crazy. We're in the wrong spot. Where do we go? But we got over a shoal spot there, and there was more current in that particular... We didn't know that. It was more current in that particular spot than it was either side of it. Guys would go by on either side. Gee, you fell off, foolish.
At a standstill.
You just see the little guys laughing at you, you know. Oh, Cunningham, he's sitting out there in the wrong spot. Well, the tide goes out and leaves you high and dry sitting out in the water. That would have been worse. We never did go aground. We came pretty close to it. We usually had a, on the 12th, we usually had a local pilot who was supposed to be pretty good. I don't know whether they were or not, but...
You had to have faith in them.
Well, you had to have faith in something. Either that or you're always swinging a lead line, because you'd want to tack up shore to get out of the main current of the Solent, because it used to sweep right down the Solent. And tide would change every 4 hours, you know. I mean, it was a back and forth. It wasn't a six-hour tide. It was, it would go and come, and you know, really whistle 6-8 knots. You couldn't buck it. You just had to work up the beaches, and that's the only way you could do it with the lead. If you hit a rock, you hit a rock.
Well, that's great.